7, 8, 9, 10. Ideally, I can set the whole thing over here and forget about it. Yeah, it'll pick up.
I'll pull a little closer. So. That's good. That's gonna work now. Trying just to say something. I see it really good. Well, I can.
Was that a transistor?
Yes.
Set there.
Yeah.
I used to have one. Very.
People like some of the students I encountered there in 55 and 6. Those opinions were strong. Some people were segregation. They said, but this is an attack on my personal liberty, you see. I won't be told by Sullins what I'm going to think or do. I'll hear anybody. I won't hear anybody that I want to hear. I'll read any book I want to read. Say that I'm segregation, but I don't want my personal liberty infringed as the way these people try to do. This all the way up to views such as being, you know, not resigned to integration, but for it.
Yeah.
Now, what's happened to those kids? This is only 8 years ago.
Yeah.
What's happened to them?
When I went to Ole Miss in 54, this was strong there. This position was, I would say, represented 75-80% of the student body. And a vast majority of the students would say, yes, I favor desegregation. But before I left, I was only there 2.5 years. Before I left there, that had completely reversed. And I think the White Citizen Council was just that strong in that state, and is just that strong. Of course, it was much stronger now than they were when I left there in the latter part of 56. So that you still have a few students arguing this position, but not very many.
What happened to them? How did they come to make a change in their minds? Or what happened to those who haven't changed their minds?
When these kids were growing up, I wasn't, too far ahead of them. I'm not as old as my hairline would indicate. When I was growing up, for instance, down in Mid-County in the southwest Mississippi over toward Baton Rouge, this wasn't really an issue. I mean, we assumed, that there were white kids and Negro kids, or nigger kids, and we assumed that they didn't go to school together, but nobody ever talked about it, So that when I got grown and went away to college and the Army and so on, I was really free to make up my own mind. But these students, they hear this. I'm sure you've seen the manual for Southerners and so on. They hear it in the school, in the church, in the home, from the day they're born. And so that it is an issue with them. But it's a closed matter. It's not really in the public opinion process. So by the time they get to college, nothing to talk about.
You mean the ones who are in college now?
The ones in college now. As to what happened to those students that you're referring to, they're all over the country, and I think a lot of them are making a real mark for themselves. Now, of course, those who remained in Mississippi, they pretty much, I think, went along with culture. They became lawyers and doctors and school teachers and so on.
The pressure set in on them.
Yeah.
Well, this tale is... I've heard it's all changed there now in the last few years.
Oh, yeah.
Theo Van Wood has, for instance, and others.
Yeah.
Who looked into it.
Yeah. I think what Jim Silver says, what he said in his Asheville speech, pretty accurate. It's really a closed society. There's just not room for any dissent. Even when I was there was room to fight. You could fight. Now, you didn't get much of a violence. You didn't get much support, but you could fight if you what I said to students always was, look, there's no such thing as denial of freedom of speech. Nobody can deny me freedom of speech. The only way they can do it is kill me. It's just a matter of whether or not I want to pay the price. Well, the price at that time I was willing to pay, because it was a very modest price. Some folks didn't like you, and some folks would try to get you fired, but that's not much of a price. There's really a lot of fun in that. It's exciting. But hell, the price now is really whether or not you're going to be able to survive economically and even physically.
Well, there's a good chance that a colored man won't survive physically.
Yes, sir. It sure is.
Well, that's been proved.
It certainly has, on several occasions.
What about Dr. Silvers?
Well, of course, Jim is in a better position now, so far as his job security is concerned, which never bothered him much anyway. He's in a better position than he's ever been in because of this accreditation thing. Folks like John Dell Williams and so on, they say they're not concerned with accreditation. I think probably they tell the truth. They aren't. But an awful lot of people in the state are. And if they fired Jim Silver now, that would just be it. They'd lose their accreditation, sure as the world. So I don't think Jim is in any trouble there, but I do think that he's in physical danger. I really believe that. I think that somebody could pick him off as easily as they picked Ned Evers off. Of course, when you start shooting white folks, it's a little different,
Do you have any notion about the
jury on the Beckwith trial. Do you have any guesses about that? Was that a straight verdict? Somebody stood up against the majority, against the jury, or so, it was rigged?
I doubt it was rigged. You're talking about this crop in the middle 50s and early 50s there. One of the prosecutors in this case was a boy named John Fox, and he's assistant DA down there. And Fox, I know, was trying for a conviction on that thing. There wasn't any question about that. He wanted a conviction. He'd try again. He was one of this crop. He was an old man. Of course, his father teaches law there.
And Walla.
I think Walla did too. I don't know Walla. I never did know him, but I knew Fox quite well. So the fact that they got a hung jury makes even an old hard-nosed Calvinist like myself almost believe in progress, because when I was a kid, this, you know, never would have been reported.
Some Negroes have said to me that even if it was rigged, the fact of rigging it indicated something. They attributed vice pays to virtue. Even if necessity putting on a drama would indicate something. But the cynicism about it is pretty widespread among, as far as I could make out, among Negroes.
Oh, there's no question about that.
This is somehow a deception.
Well, of course, the man will go free. I don't think there's much question about that. But the fact that he has been detained this long, that it's been this much of a nuisance to him, indicates that something is on its way. You know, something is beginning to happen here. There's no question about it that the reason that Fox and Waller wanted the man committed at Whitfield was that then they had a certainty that he would not be on the loose. But of course, the defense didn't want him committed, just the opposite of what you usually have. Defense is saying what they're saying with Jack Ruby in Dallas. Prosecution is trying to prove that he was. In this case, prosecution wanted to commit him to Whitfield, because then they would have had him, you know. But as it is, I don't imagine they're terribly optimistic about it.
What did you make of the editorial in the Clarksdale paper after the acquittal of Kimball, the man who killed the young Negro
Till.
Melton, not Kid Till, had been, he was presumably mixed up in the other, the unknown man. Who later, as he said, it's not fair that others getting all the publicity, I want some. He said before he killed Melton. But the Clarksdale paper, if my memory doesn't trick me, came out after the acquittal and said there was some excuse in the Till case, if not, for the verdict, at least for the motives behind the verdict, with some sense of interference and pressure and conflicting evidence. In this case, it was clear, there were eyewitnesses, and we flunked it. This is on the front page of the Clarksdale paper. That man must have had some nerve.
Well, in a sense, yes, but it seems to, I don't remember that exact editorial, but I would guess that what you had there was sort of the tail end of the old noblesse oblige, which I don't shrug off the way some folks do. I think there was this period in Southern history, and I think there was a time when you looked after your own. I think it was a very unfortunate period in Southern history, because it really has sort of led to most of our troubles of today, because this was the aristocratic white South, which people, you know, poo-poo today and say this was just a myth. Well, it wasn't a myth. Now, I wasn't a part of this white aristocracy. I came from that, from those poor hill whites, you know. But I think there was this period in Southern history when folks did the best they could under the circumstances toward those they ruled. I say it was a tragic period and an evil period, as it turned out, because there was nothing Christian in it. And this, of course, is my only concern. I'm not interested in race for any political or social reasons or anything else, as far as I can determine why I'm interested in it. It's purely on the basis of my understanding of Christian faith, and there was nothing Christian in this position. It was Stoic, it seems to me. You, of course, know a lot more about this than I do. But there was this period, and I would guess that this is what you had happening in Clarksdale here, these people who did behave justly and decently and honorably as best they knew how toward those they governed, but who had this hierarchy of creation that the right to rule and here's naturally and the best man, the Stoic position again here. But then when those they ruled got unruly, and this alliance between the Uncle Tom or the Lucas Beecham and the Colonel Sartorius, when this broke down, when they didn't come to the big house any longer but went to Washington and joined the labor union in NAACP, then a Christian position, I think, if you had had a Christian influence in that same period, it could have survived this. But the Stoic position, I think, couldn't survive it and didn't survive it. So that these people today, for the most part, well, you know who and where they are and what they're doing. They're either sitting silently and getting some little glee out of watching the world crumble down around them, or they're giving leadership in White Citizen Council and John Birch Societies, as some of the white aristocracy with whom you have reason to be quite familiar in this area are doing. And what they say, and this is something I think that the people in race relations, the experts, the professionals are not recognizing the degree, the amount of truth that the White Citizen Councils, particularly the Mississippi brand of the White Citizen Council, which is what you have in Nashville right now, it's a graph from that element. John Casper tried to bring something a little more idiotic in here, but it didn't take, you know, he didn't get a following with the Mississippi branch, because they are smart people, because they do represent this cultured elite. They are getting a following and a hearing here. And I lost my train of thought there, but do you see what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, you say that the present generation who inherited from the old Stoic aristocracy now has gone over to the Citizens Council.
That's right, and they, yeah, I remember what I was trying to say. We say, well, all this they say about the Negroes and so on is not true, you know. We can prove it's not true. Well, you can't prove it's not true. Most of what they say is true, and if you grant them their premise, there's absolutely no way to beat them. They say that if you bring all the Negroes from out in the Delta into town, put them into one of Mr. Kennedy's or none of Mr. Johnson's housing projects and send them to the same school, so you're going to have a lot of trouble. They're saying that the Negroes are not ready to come into white society. Well, if you accept what they mean by Southern white society, then they're telling the truth. They're manipulating the truth, but they're not lying. What they say about this element of the Negro population is accurate, is true, but it's not the issue in the Christian understanding, is what I'm trying to say. And what the pros do, they go down and they say to the plantation owner, well, now we're not talking about your field hands out here, we're talking about folks like Ralph Bunch and Marian Anderson. Now, how many people like that, how many of our fine, cultured, educated, articulate Negroes do you know and have ever talked to? Now, if this man were really smart, he'd look out the window and call one of his field hands and say, well, how many folks like this man do you know? And the truth is, the plantation owner, he generally knows more folks like Ralph Bunch than we know folks like he is with every day. Christian position, seems to me, is that this is not relevant. This doesn't make any difference what this man is.
Well, there's another question that enters that I'd like to ask, and not in a polemical spirit. What socially can be done here? You clearly know by means to bring in, say, 200,000 Negroes from rural Mississippi and put them in housing place tomorrow morning.
Yeah, yeah.
Put them in school tomorrow morning.
Yeah, yeah.
Is this a tactic, the Citizens Council people, of assuming that this means literally tomorrow morning without any reference to social process?
I think it's a tactic of the...
They know it can kind of be, isn't it?
Yeah. It's clearly a tactic of the top brass, but the people down in the ranks who send in their $5 a year and who go to the mass meetings and who constitute the mobs at Oxford and who will constitute mobs in Jackson when and if white, or not if, but when Negro kids enter the previously all-white schools there. I don't think it's a tactic with these people. They do fear. They have accepted this from the top brass.
Does they assume it's going to happen tomorrow morning with no period of transition?
Yeah. They don't understand transition, you see. You know, they can't quite grasp this.
Well, now this leads to two questions. One is, how much, quotes the mob, represents the Southern white majority will? And the other question is, how does a Negro understand, quotes, transition social process? Let's take the first one first. James Baldwin and a lot of other Negroes I know, who know all whose writings I have read, will say that the Southern mob, outside the high school in Little Rock or elsewhere, does not represent the will of the majority. It moves into a moral vacuum. This is one view. Many Negroes will deny it, of course, but many right now in Jackson, Mississippi, will say it's true. Everyone said it's true, for instance.
Yeah.
But what do you think about that? Does that make, what kind of sense does that make, or what kind of explanation must be made of it to make it make sense?
I don't know, it'd be purely a guess. I think that the mob at Oxford represented first the opinion and position of the leadership, and then that when it actually happened, it represented the will of the majority, or else Paul Johnson wouldn't have been elected governor, because this was the only issue they ran on.
How much of a vote abstains and doesn't move in Mississippi? I don't even know the figures on the potential white vote as opposed to the, it's contrasted with the number of actual voters.
Well, I don't think very many people consciously abstain. I don't think you'd find 200 in the whole state who just said, well, no hope, plague on all their house, and I won't even bother to go and vote. That's a guess, but...
Of course, I know a few people like that in Mississippi who just say the hell with it, but I don't know what they represent, you see.
I don't think they represent much. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you had in the group that voted, you can look at the vote for J.P. Coleman, an awful lot of people, of course, didn't really know what the issues were, but I think the most of them did know what the issues were, and Coleman got an awful lot of votes. And I think this vote, if there is any hope, it lies in this large group that cast the ballot to J.P. Coleman, knowing that this was moving in the direction of bringing some order out of the chaos, and knowing that, yes, this means a little desegregation in this state, in the schools, and so on.
How heavy was the vote for him?
I don't remember the exact total, but he got in the primary, first primary, I think he got, let's see, how many men were running? He got close to 40%, if I'm not mistaken.
There were three or four men running, weren't there?
Yeah, you had Sullivan, Johnson, and Coleman. knew that at the time, I felt sure that at the time, if Colvin didn't go in, if he didn't get a majority of the votes in the first primary, that he'd just be out of luck, you know. Because the folks who were going to vote for him voted for him the first time around.
And there would be no force he could pick up on the runoff then.
No. Same way with Morrison in Louisiana.
Yes.
Same thing happened then.
In other words, their notions of
separatism is a screen. They expect to stay right in there and have federal money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
But this is not the what the ordinary man in the street, Mississippi, will say. He says, out, I want out. This is us. And we go all the way. Dissolve our ties. At least some will say that.
Yeah, yeah. But you don't hear Jim Eastman saying that.
No. No, you won't hear him saying that. May I cut back to the other question about...
Are you warming up there?
I'm fine, I'm fine. This is fine. I'm even... I'm going to take my coat off. But the question of transition, I found that if you present to a certain number of Negroes a quotation by a Negro or by various Negroes on the point that social change is never immediate and never absolute, and the race problem is one of these social situations which is bound to be in terms of historical process. Read this quote or hand this quote and ask, what do you make of that in relation to the slogan, Freedom Now? It extracts some very peculiar responses. Sometimes you get very rational ones, of course. Sometimes you get a student, and a very, very bright fellow indeed, at Southern said to me, well, of course this is true. And then made, you know, some of our historical examples.
Yeah.
They said, but I can't bring myself to say it.
Yeah, yeah.
Just that split right in the middle of his sentence.
Yeah, well, this, of course, this makes sense, too. Man's got his foot on your neck. If you could, you know, if you were in a position to be rational about this, you would could say, well, I know that even if this man decides to take his foot off my neck and get my head out of the gravel here, that it takes a little time for him to pick his foot up, move it off, and then for me to put my hands on the ground and push myself up and get up, that's gradualism. So that's the way it's going to be. But he's not in a position to be rational about this. He's in a position to say, get your foot off my neck now. And it's a desperate sort of thing. So that any Negro leader who talks in terms of time and working this out and transition and all that is not going to be a Negro leader very long.
But he may say privately, quite different.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
As some will say to me privately,
yeah.
Of course, there are some very sophisticated people who know a lot of history involved in that.
Yeah, yeah, sure. But, and I think, again, that these people are doing this country a great service. The people who are saying freedom now, and the leaders like Wilkins and Farmer and King and so on, because I'm just as certain that they serve as a buffer. These people who are not revolutionaries, but who are social reformers.
You mean like Farmer and King?
King, yes, and Wilkins. Wilkins, classic example
I
think. Because here is an extremely sophisticated man who does want to work the thing out, who honestly doesn't want revolution, he's American through and through. But I'm quite convinced that waiting in the wings for one misstep or misjudgment on the part of the social reformers are those who are not nonviolent and who are not social reformers, but who are revolutionaries. And I am further convinced that the there is sufficient anti-white feeling among American Negroes that they can get a following, and a sizable following in a very short period of time, if the Kings and the Wilkins, the farmers, should be discredited among the masses, that this would be the next step. And I don't think they're confined to the black Muslims. In fact, I doubt if the Muslims would ever, or some of the, those who are black Muslims might be in this leadership, but not as black Muslims.
There's another view that I've encountered in both Louisiana and Mississippi, more often in Mississippi. People who prefer the social reform approach, but begin to despair of it, and say what we need is a piece of controlled violence, a Machiavellian technique to dramatize violence as a possibility and then contain it, which is a very, I should say, a dreamer's view about the nature of violence.
It sure is. It's a dangerous position, of course. I think there's no question that, I mean, Charles Johnson was saying this, 20 years ago, that though he was a man who certainly deplored violence, and yet he saw that always progress was made following an outbreak of violence. And it has happened, and the movement, you can see this, this thinking influencing the movement, the Negro movement today. Happened in this town as recently as last May, when as long as John Lewis and a few Fisk and Tennessee State students were down there picketing and stepping back at the restaurant when the white folks entered and opening the door and bowing gracefully, nothing happened. The city went on about its way. But when these same people began locking arms in front of the restaurants and blocking entrances and you know, a little pushing back and grabbing billy sticks now and then and so on. And then when you've got an undisciplined force at work there, still drawing from Negro students largely, but who didn't know anything about John Lewis's nonviolence. You know, they say, yeah, sure, when they go to the mass meeting, but when they get out there in the street and folks start throwing rocks and bottles, they were inclined to throw rocks and bottles back. It was only through men like Max Rollins, who then was working for the United Presbyterian Church here, a Negro clergyman from the South, and John Lewis and some others, who were able to contain this. But when the violence really became obvious and actual, then the city, you had appointed here one of the strongest human relations committees I've ever seen anywhere. It had 9%, probably 9% of the wealth in the city on this committee. Well, they weren't so concerned as long as Negro students were down there nonviolently picketing and bowing and so on. So it's inevitable that this will get into the thinking of the students and so on. And of course, what they say is right. It's true. Don't say it's right, but it's true that when there is an outbreak of violence, then people get excited, they get scared, they begin trying to do something. Now, this is what they mean by control violence.
Yes, yes.
I don't think any of these students who were, you know, maybe were a little bit glad that there was a little bit of violence, which didn't represent the leadership, but it seemed to be, but represented the thinking of a sizable group there. I don't think any of those students, though, really wanted an outbreak. You know, first of all, they're smarter than that. They know that they would lose. If it just fought out on that basis, they know they would lose. But as you say, this is a pretty naive view of the nature of violence and the nature of man.
The phrase, the brinksmanship of violence kept appearing at the Conference on Nonviolence at Howard University last November.
Yeah.
That phrase began to emerge.
Yeah.
And of course, there was every possible view of the nature of violence and the justification of violence.
Well, I've greatly admired the leaders of the nonviolent movement.
understanding of the nature of man, it doesn't leave me a great deal of optimism as to how long it would last in a real crisis such as most people feel is going to come in Mississippi.
Do you remember an essay by Dr. Kenneth Clark on the nature of nonviolence? It's a passage in a longer study. He says this, this is a rough paraphrase, that at first glance it seems that King's philosophy represents stability and reason, but as opposed to the black Muslim philosophy, which represents, say, at first glance, instability and the pathological. But, he continues, a deeper analysis may well show instability and a lack of realism, if not downright pathology, in the King's attitude. And he says that the resistance to violence, the reaction to oppression or injustice is normally resentment and the will to strike back. Therefore, to ask the victim of oppression to love his oppressor imposes an intolerable psychological burden which is not healthy. Now this question is, the answer to this question by many Negroes is yes, he's right. And there's a whole scaling of attitudes up to the straight King line or the Lawson line.
Yeah, yeah.
Would you speak on that question, that topic?
Well, I don't remember that essay. I know.
I think it's a fair paraphrase.
I know Ken Clark quite well. We've been on a lot of committees and so on together. And
I haven't talked with him yet. I'm going to be talking to him.
Years. Well, I know this would be what he would say, and I couldn't agree more. Though Ken probably is saying it from a social psychologist's point of view, and I would say it from a theological point of view, but we're both saying the same thing, actually. This is what man is like.
Two or three Negroes have said to me, this is what man is like unredeemed.
Yeah.
And say, but I am a Christian, so this Negro will say, I believe in the redemptive process, you see, of turning the other cheek, of understanding that we must transcend the nature of man.
I don't
think in terms of redeem human nature.
I think this is possible, and I think this redemption can be seen in men like James Lawson. I think James Lawson would let you kill him before he hit you back. But this represents a very small minority.
It has to be tactics of nonviolence for the great majority. Always, Dr. Abbott has said, when someone asked me this question in my presence, he said, I believe it at the level of Christian philosophy. And he grinned and said, but the white folks have the most guns.
Yeah, right. Well, Kelly Smith, I believe you're going to talk to him.
I have talked with him, yes. I had a long talk yesterday with him.
Well, he said something here in the school desegregation crisis, what was that, 57, I guess, when one of the Negro ministers came out of school leading a little girl by the hand and pulled a gun when the mob closed in around him. And of course,
this was a Negro father, you mean?
Well, no, he was a Negro minister.
A Negro minister.
He walked to school with one of his little parishioners. And as they were coming out, the mob closed in. Well, the day before, the mother of the child had taken a knife out of her bosom, a paring knife. And of course, she was immediately arrested and taken off to jail. The next day, the pastor went to school with the child. When they closed in on him, he pulled a gun out. And of course, Kelly Smith, being the leader here and the man that he is, immediately convened a meeting of all the Negro ministers, and I sort of lost my racial identity. I guess I was involved in this group. And Kelly said, let's just understand one thing.
So we don't make any guns. We got to buy them all from the rifles. We don't make any knives. All the knives that we buy, we've got to buy them from the rifles. They make them. As far as I know, we don't even make any ice picks or razors. We got to buy all those. So if this is where we choose to fight it out, we're going to lose. And it's just that simple.
I heard Farmer say on a platform at Howard, to the question of brinksmanship or controlled violence or even violence, just this: if you take to the streets on this issue at this time, you're courting disaster.
Yeah, well, this would certainly be Farmer's position. I'm
yes.
Sure.
But there are certainly people in Jackson, Negroes, who said they missed a great chance for the showdown in the riot at Jackson College 2 weeks ago.
I don't believe it. I think the showdown has to be, and will be, I believe, brought on by whites. This is
precipitated by whites?
Yes. I this is my opinion.
That is, there was some real sneer at Evers for going into the crowd of students and trying to quiet them and disperse them.
Yeah, this is why I said a while ago that men like Evers and Farmer and Wilkins, man, if the whites in Mississippi only knew how good a friend these people are to them, they would subsidize them. Because I don't think there's any question of the hostility, that the anti-white feeling, just as there's no question about the anti-Negro feeling all over this country, something that's greatly minimized, I think, north and south.
You think it's growing in the north?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. It's growing because it's becoming more real.
There's never been an issue in the same way before.
No,
except a sporadic riots like Chicago or St. Louis.
Yeah, and even then, you know, people weren't really threatened, you know. There wasn't the possibility of a Negro living next door to them or going to their church or even, for the most part, to their school. Except, you know, a few who already... I get frightened when I go back to Mississippi, but I get more frightened when I go to some of the large industrial centers in the north, New York, Chicago, so...
I talked with a young girl, really, she's only in her earliest 20s, who is second in a law class at Howard, raised on a small backcountry farm in Virginia, terribly bright girl, who's been through the mill. She's been in the jails and on the picket lines, and has still kept her intellectual drive. She's a hard student, terribly bright. She says that she has real optimism about the settlement in the South, the question. She said she thinks that the Southern white man and the Southern Negro have something fundamentally in common. As she said, a common history. And they're both on the same land. And they have some sense of a person. She said she's frightened of Chicago, Detroit, New York. What basis is there for a human recognition?
No.
And she shrinks and I said she can't think about that. She can't see the possibility.
Yeah. Of course, the same thing is beginning to happen in the South as the South becomes industrialized.
Birmingham, for instance?
Yeah. But I think time running out so rapidly that before the South reaches that point, the real crisis will have come. And I think she's right. I think it can all probably, I think it'll come in Mississippi, but I think it will also come in the big
remember Carl Rowan writing years back that the Southern Troubles would be a dress rehearsal for the big Northern Troubles.
Yeah. Well, I agree. I think this is true. I'm a little sentimental about the South, I'm sure, but what this girl is saying, I think, is true, and I wouldn't romanticize it the way some folks do. But I do think that there is a more of a personal relationship, even fighting a man is recognizing him as a human being, but just to ignore him completely, so that he's got to chain himself to water towers and throw himself down in front of bulldozers and all this before you even recognize him. I mean, it's just jumping up and saying, you know, here we are, like a child in the family who'd rather get a whipping, you know, than no response from the parents at all.
What do you think of the policy that's taken by some Negro organizations about the bus transfers in New York and elsewhere? Arbitrary integration in this sense, moving white children from a long way off to put them in a Negro school to balance out enrollment. Does that make any sense?
It might make some sense in an immediate, as an expediency, but it's not an answer.
There's no answer in Washington, D.C. of that kind. We have 85% of the schools Negro. Where are you going to get the balance of money?
Yeah.
And you hear this, a white parent saying, I would welcome any Negro into the school where my child is, but I will not let my child be bussed away and put 2 hours on a bus.
Yeah.
A child of 8 or 9 years old. That kind of practical approach. This is a person who believes, you see, in integrating the schools, but says there are prices I refuse to pay for it.
Yeah. Well, this is, I think, some more of the. It reflects that some more Yankee stupidity, it seems to me, and that there has been the choice to take this approach rather than attack it where it really exists, and that is in the area of housing, the whole housing pattern. This is what folks will get maddest about. They'll get mad at busing their children across town, but they would prefer that even, generally, to living in a truly integrated neighborhood.
Well, some Negroes have said to me up in Connecticut and such places that this demand for the busing system of integration of schools is a tactic. It's really a weapon.
Yeah.
That nobody believes it can do anything except create, dramatize the situation.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know how close these Negroes are to big leadership. They aren't at the top. They are local leaders. I don't know how much this comes out of the inside of the New York organization. And of course, if they are using it tactically, they're not going to say so anyway.
Yeah, sure.
This is a comment from other Negroes who are not in the center of command. You would incline to agree then, is this right, with the attitude that you get no solution to the question until you get a change in the North? Baldwin says that, others say that, that the key is a change in the North.
All right, I think there's any question about that. Seems to me.
The South will not resolve its difficulties until the North has.
Well, the South followed the North and everything else for the last 100 years. Probably followed in this too.
Though I don't believe that some of the Mississippi Negro leaders are going to wait for that.
No. There isn't time. There isn't time for it. That's the tragedy. This is what frustrating thing to me. And I'm convinced that really it's too late. My concern is the church here again. It's too late for the church to do what it is doing today. This might have been the church's call and witness to the gospel a few decades ago, maybe even one decade ago. But it's too late now for it to do this.
To do which?
To concern itself, which it is doing, primarily with simple justice. This, again, seems to me in the Christian understanding, a concern primarily with simple justice is a concern with law. And in the Christian understanding, law, the concern with law leads to death, is death. And this is really what the churches are doing, it seems to me.
What do you think should be the line of the church now?
Well, I think what I tried to say throughout this little book was that was written 2 or 3 years ago, but I don't think I've changed my mind about very many times I tried to say that. But the concern of the church should be a renewal, an understanding, a discovery of who and what it is. And when it discovers this, it discovers that race doesn't even exist in the Christian faith. That when St. Paul said in 2 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, as I recall, that no longer do we recognize worldly distinctions. If we did once in our understanding of Christ, we do so no longer. Now this, the church thinks it's being radical when it's marching on the picket line and walking in front of courthouses in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and Clarksdale, and so on, and maybe it is. But if the church could confront, and I'm thinking again as a Southerner, because that's what I am, if it could confront the traditional folk religion of the South with this radical understanding of the gospel, people in the South won't hear words like, the white people won't hear words like constitution, law and order. Understandably, this is not really in our history. In Mississippi, we're just now beginning to take seriously our own constitution of 1890. And law and order, this is a region of violence. But they will hear, they may not understand them in the finest orthodox sense, but the barrier to the wall doesn't drop between you and them when you begin to use words like redemption and reconciliation and God and Christ and so on. They've heard these words all their life. Now, when you confront this traditional folk religion with this radical ethic, then it seems to me there is some hope. Because then you're saying to people, and of course the South is always lived in this Christian edifice, but in the way that Chesterton spoke about, the man who will either come inside completely or go away, but stands forever grumbling on the porch. Then he's got to decide, and a few people are deciding. A few people are saying, well, if this is what the church stands for, this is what the Christian faith says, and the hell with it, I want no part of it. But I think most people, the devout religionists of the South, are not going to give up the church. And if they are confronted with it from this vantage point, now if they're confronted with it the way some of the top church leadership is doing, by pickets and making the same humanistic approach that groups who work in the profession, in the field of human relations, as humanistic organizations are making, then I'm going to follow the church on this. So really, I suppose what I'm saying is what the church can do is preach the gospel. Now, when you've got really to elaborate that, because people say, oh, God, here we go again. You know, we've been preaching the gospel for 2,000 years, and what good has it done? It hadn't done any good. You still got segregation all over the South, so this proves that, that it's not valid. Well, that's not true. We haven't been preaching the gospel. We've been saying, been living in this Christian edifice and using these words and phrases, but not saying to people, well, now when, all right, you go ahead and believe that if you want to, that a whale swallowed Jonah, but understand how what this means is not important who your daughter marries or where your child goes to school. That when St. Paul said, go ahead and believe the words of St. Paul, yes. But no, when he said, no longer do we recognize any world of distinctions, recognize and realize that this is a very radical and revolutionary thing that this man was saying, and that's who we are as Christians. Well,
what about the fact that the word preached needs the social projection, the social dramatization, otherwise it is still a mere word?
Well, I have no
that argument.
Yeah. I have no quarrel with that. When I say preach the gospel, I don't mean in the sense of the 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. Because it's true, yes, we have had a lot of this, but we, again, have had a lot of it where the first century was concerned, but not very much where the 20th century was concerned.
You mean a lot of the action in social terms which dramatized the nature of the gospel?
Well, what we've been saying was, as St. Paul said, no longer do we recognize any worldly distinctions. Well, we tell our people that now what he was really talking about was there's no difference in the Jew and the Greek and so on. But we don't continue to say, but further what he was saying, there's no distinction between white and Negro, Oriental or Occidental.
I think I'll change tapes now. All before right. We get into trouble. This is the end of the first tape by Dr. Will Campbell of Nashville, Tennessee, February 13th.